I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray.
Welcome to Rich Text, a podcast about our cultural obsessions, like bad moms.
If you're listening today, you're already a subscriber to our audio and written newsletter, Rich Text. Thank you, as always, for being here. You quite literally make our work possible.
We are here today with journalist E.J. Dixon, whose book, One Bad Mother, In Praise of Psycho Housewives, Stage Parents, Momfluencers, and Other Women We Love to Hate, is out on February 10th. E.J., thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh my gosh, I have been so excited to talk about this book. I've been like making my way through it ever since we got the galley and just like had so many thoughts reading each chapter. So I'm glad that I finally get to like give all of those thoughts a home rather than just like talking to myself and writing little notes in the margins.
So we wanted to ask you, like, what drew you personally to this topic? How did you land on this?
I think just becoming a mom and realizing how much everybody hates you afterwards. That's the short answer, really. Just how surprising that was to me. Although really it shouldn't have been. I mean, you get the cultural message that that's going to happen to you, like basically since you're born. But yeah, that was kind of it.
Yeah, I do feel like there's like a little bit of a millennial phenomenon where we were all like, we're different. Like, we're the women who will get to have it all and we aren't going to be hated. And like, moms are a separate category of like bad, boring women. And then we became moms and it's like, oh no.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I write about that in the book. Like, I truly believed that I would be like sitting in the office, like barking orders to my subordinates, wearing these like nap dresses with like Converse and like breastfeeding my son and being like, go get me a Kind bar from the kitchen because I'd be working someplace that had like free snacks. And that is just, and everybody else would be like nursing their infants and like wearing Converse with nap dresses too. And that was just like, that's just not the reality. Like, it's just,
I mean, that sounds like a beautiful workplace and I'd like to go there.
I actually wouldn't at the time. I mean, it sounded kind of ideal to me.
I think I just miss working in a corporate setting where I got a lot of free snacks.
Kind bars.
Free lunches. Yeah. No one is just providing free snacks for me anymore.
Well, EJ, you know, I had a baby 3 months before COVID lockdowns.
Oh,
so
wow.
I went back to work in that office, except I was the only one there. And very quickly you're like, oh my God, this baby is just not letting me eat my Kind bar and like wear my nap dress. This baby is actually a huge distraction from being a girl boss right now.
Yeah, babies don't let you girl boss or gaslight or gatekeep.
Yeah, they clock it right away. They're like, that's enough of that. So how do you define a bad mother for the purposes of this book?
How do I define a bad mother? Well, I mean, really, right off the bat, you know, the definition of bad mother is so expansive. You can call someone a bad mother if they're too permissive. You can call someone a bad mother if they're not permissive enough. You can call someone a bad mother if they let their kid have too much screen time. You can call someone a bad mother if they don't let their kid have any screen time at all. It's really something that can be used to apply to virtually any woman who does virtually anything. So that's kind of the reason why it works so well.
Yeah. It's like a bit of a moving target that completely changes situationally. And I guess then, is there even a platonic ideal of the good mom? Like, if the idea of a bad mom is so expansive and so hard to define, is it possible to define what the culture thinks of as a quote unquote good mom?
Yeah, I think that it's very easy to pin down like what a good mother is, in especially in American culture. I mean, it's very much influenced by this 19th century ideal of the angel in the house, which stems from this 19th century poet called Coventry Patmore, who like very clearly hated women. And
sorry, whenever you wrote that name, I was just like, I thought you were referring to like a brand of kitchenware or something. It was very hard to understand that Coventry Patmore was a person's
name. A real human.
A real human. It's either a brand of kitchenware or somebody who like very obviously hated women.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it was the latter. And it's very much this trope of like the Industrial Revolution era woman who serves as this like purifying force in the home for the husband to come back and be greeted in the warm bosom of the wife and mother, this like flaxen haired, white, of course, upper middle class housewife, domestic goddess type. And that's pretty much the trope that we've been working with ever since. It hasn't really deviated from that. That's what we see on Instagram in like various forms. Like it's kind of the same wine bottle, different labels.
Right. So we're working off of this very limiting model and then anything that diverts from that. And as you outline, even people who seem to fall within that can also at times be labeled bad moms.
Absolutely. Like, as I write in the chapter on momfluencers, Hannah Nealman is Ballerina Farm, who I'm sure you guys have talked about on here, is basically the platonic ideal of the angel in the house. And her comments are constantly full of people shitting on her for not tapping an egg correctly, or, you know, her feet are dirty, or her feet are not dirty. These are not actual comments I've seen, but I'm assuming that she's got a foot fetishist in her comments somewhere being like, your feet aren't dirty enough.
There's always one.
Yeah, exactly. You just can't win.
Do we think Hannah Nealman is on WikiFeet? That's where my head is going.
almost certainly.
Yeah.
Are you guys on WikiFeet?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think I am.
I don't think that I'm famous enough.
Our dear friend Laura Bassett is famously on WikiFeet, but I don't think I've made it.
Yeah, Brittany Spanos is famously on WikiFeet. So I would bet you're on WikiFeet.
I'm afraid to look. I'm afraid because it would also hurt my feelings if I weren't on WikiFeet, you know? Like, I'd rather just not know. When you were writing in your book about the angel in the house trope, I was really struck by the fact that you bring up Marmee from Little Women, who, of course, is like the ultimate angel in the house. But I had never thought of her that way, even though I was like familiar with this angel in the house archetype. But it is true that like Marmee is like my ideal mom. And I think pretty frequently now that I have two kids about that conversation she has with Joe, where she tells her basically, I get angry, but I never, ever, ever show it.
Yeah.
And I tell myself, like, if I were a really good mom, I would never get angry with my kids. But every day I fall short of that. And it's interesting how that propaganda had worked on me without my ever even noticing it, even though I pride myself on being a pretty perceptive reader. And so I really appreciated that you called that out.
And also, what a crazy thing to let, like, I think that there's a generation of literary women who grow up idolizing Jo March just precisely for being outspoken and speaking her mind and being, I mean, let's just say it, like, queer-coded. But it's, and there's Marmee sort of saying the opposite and telling her to, like, suppress her impulses and suppress the thing that, like, all of millions and millions of female readers love about her. So, yeah, I think it's so interesting that you pointed that out, that it's just kind of like that trope just worms your way into its subconscious so much that you don't even clock how crazy what she's saying really is.
Yeah. And Jo, ultimately, we see in the later books, like, grow up to be a somewhat Marmee-esque figure.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
Like the idealized mom and educator.
Yeah, in the sequels. I totally forgot about that. She totally does.
Yeah, and so there is that attempt to kind of like resolve, like, well, she's still our headstrong, ambitious, brilliant Jo, but to her children and her students, she will always be endlessly patient and be working to provide ideal moral and intellectual instruction at all times. It's an impossible ideal to live up to, but Jo manages to like completely form herself to that.
Does she have kids? I forget if she becomes a mother.
Yeah. Or no. Does she only have her students?
I don't remember. I remember trying to read.
It might just be that she has students.
Yeah. As like the surrogate kid. I know Louisa May Alcott famously never married or had kids, but that book was so boring. I remember trying to read Joe's Boys or whatever it's called. I was so bored. Because she just became so boring.
Google says she has two sons.
She has two sons.
Oh, okay.
Just like the two of you.
Yeah. Look at us.
But she's better because she's fictional.
She never gets mad.
You're a boy mom too?
I am a boy mom.
And you never get mad at your children and you're a boy mom? Wow.
Never.
Look at you.
Constantly, constantly yelling at my kids. Well, that was one like element of the bad mother question that I was like, this is what I think about the most is what a bad mom I am for getting angry at my kids and for not like gentle parenting them like adequately. Like, how do you feel about the sort of gentle mom propaganda that we're surrounded by right now? Is that something that plays on your mind when you're trying to like figure out whether you're a good enough mom?
Oh, boy. I think the gentle parenting ideology is the fucking stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. When I hear people talk in low voices to their two-year-old children on the playground when they're, like, trying to scratch another child's eyes out and they're like, Elijah Bluebird, please don't do that. Respect that child's autonomy. I just, like, want to jump off of a cliff. I mean, aside from the fact that it's like personally annoying to me, which it very much is, like it's very much personally annoying to me. I mean, I just think it's a continuation of the Marmy March thing, you know, and disguised as progressive parenting. This book actually, like something about this book is that it kind of started out as this treatise about how a lot of the things that progressive Brooklyn moms are told to do, like breastfeeding and attachment parenting and baby wearing and co-sleeping, actually stems from like extreme right-wing propaganda. Like if you research the history of those practices, it's all like very fundamentalist Christian rooted. And I mean, if I haven't researched like the history of gentle parenting that carefully, but I would guess that it has similar roots because that's, I mean, it's literally silencing the voices of women. You know, it's saying mothers should be quiet. And I understand, you know, I'm not saying that like women should be screaming at their kids all the time. Like, although...
Sometimes, you know, like just a little bit, it can help.
Yeah, like a blanket prescription against like... If your child's trying to murder somebody, are you really going to say, like, don't scream at that? I don't know. But I just think it's so insane.
Just also kind of to me, as someone who does not have children, feels like just an impossible ideal to live up to. Like, I understand the value of saying, here are coping mechanisms. Here are ways that maybe you could communicate with a child and maybe that would be optimal. But like, who is going to go through their entire adult lives that they are raising children and never like have an emotion that raises their voice? Like, as a person who's like lived 38 years without having kids but finds myself raising my voice sometimes, I can't imagine that impulse would just dissipate the minute that like a baby comes out of my body. Like, that feels absurd.
It very much doesn't. And also like, I also just want to make my answer like a little bit more nuanced than like, this is the fucking stupidest thing I've ever heard. Every child is different, right? Every child responds different. There is no one size fits all prescription for parenting. And anybody who says there is lying to you. Every child responds differently to different disciplinary methods. I am sure there are children out there for whom gentle parenting works very well. I am not currently raising two children for whom gentle parenting works very well. I mean, one of my sons is neurodivergent and I, you know, I don't think that gentle parenting necessarily is appropriate for most neurodivergent kids for a wide variety of reasons. But yeah, I mean, I just think kids, you need to parent your kids as individuals because they are individuals. And anybody who's selling a one-size-fits-all method of parenting is just, you know, has beachfront property in a landlocked country to sell you.
Yeah.
I never remember which countries are landlocked, so I can't like cite the reference.
I probably know less about it than you do, so I couldn't begin to tell you.
I wasn't good at the geography bee.
Geography was the first period that I had in high school, and that was my nap period, so I wasn't often conscious during geography.
You had geography in high school?
Yeah.
Oh, I did not.
Weirdly.
Yeah, we didn't either.
And yet somehow I know less about geography than like anyone I know.
It didn't take.
Well, I think that I really fell for the gentle parenting stuff because anger is my vice. Like, I'm a very angry person, like Joe. I turn to anger when I'm frustrated. Like, it's like a constant issue. And I was very afraid that I was going to be too angry at my kids all the time. And that's still like my primary struggle is that I'm like, Marmy would never be angry at her kids, whereas I am literally angry at them all the time. And like, how would I feel as a kid having my mom angry at me all the time? And I think that's kind of at the heart of a lot of these questions is like, mothers and women are subjugated and judged and silenced but also we hold a greater power in that dynamic with our kids. Yeah. And so you don't want to liberate yourself at the expense of someone who needs liberation even more than you. And I feel like we get caught endlessly in that push-pull. It's like, whose needs get to take primacy, whose voice gets to be the one that's heard. And with gentle parenting, I found it didn't work at all with my older son. A lot of those methods work pretty well with my younger son. And you're that's just great. Like, I don't know. But they didn't work with my older son at all. And I thought I was just doing them wrong. But eventually you just give up.
And what you're both saying is like every child is different. Yeah. And you kind of throw shit at the wall and see what sticks, which makes sense to me. Any relationship is going to have different needs depending on the people involved in that relationship.
Absolutely.
And I have to imagine that has to include mothers and children.
Yeah. By the end of writing this book, had it changed like how much you measured yourself against like a good mom versus bad mom kind of yardstick?
Absolutely.
That's heartening. It can happen.
Absolutely. I think that I just don't care anymore, honestly, to a large extent. While I was writing this book, I think the main takeaway, like it's supposed to be funny, like ostensibly, like it's supposed to make people laugh.
It is.
And it's supposed to be interesting, ostensibly, like it's supposed to make people think. But the main thing I want people, particularly women, to be is angry. I want people to be angry. I want women and mothers to be angry that they have essentially been sold a false bill of goods, because a lot of these constructions of what it means to be a good mother or what it means to be a bad mother are societally imposed and are dependent on whatever the needs of society or the political structure are at any given time. And they're essentially made up, you know, they're bullshit. The whole idea of the June Cleaver housewife entirely arises from the need to drive women back from the workforce into the home after World War II. I mean, it just pops up again and again and again. It is all basically made up. And that should piss people off. That should make women really angry. Like, yeah. All of these pressures are just totally made up. I see it happening again in, like, even more so now, you know, with Trump in office and with the, you know, the tradwife aesthetic gaining steam on social media and all this talk about pronatalism. And I just want people to get angry, because I think we should be.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this book is particularly important in this moment for all of those reasons. And I want to get into all of that. But first, I wanted to ask, obviously, something that comes up a lot in the book is the question of race and how race plays into this like construction of good versus bad motherhood. And you speak with a researcher who explicitly states that like the category of good mother was constructed to exclude Black women.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how your research sharpened your understanding of the role that race plays in like who gets to be a good mother or a bad mother.
Well, it's basically inextricable, right? I mean, it comes up in every single chapter for a reason, because it's so permeated. It's so integral to our conception of a good mother. The angel in the house is white, you know, and anything that deviates from that is considered suspect. And that's really held primacy in our culture. And you look at, you know, the rates of the children who are taken into custody by child protective services, they are overwhelmingly children of color. And there are overwhelmingly mothers of color who are incarcerated. I mean, it's just obvious that if you deviate from the white Christian model of motherhood, that you are considered suspect in this country, both literally and figuratively. And I was very conscious while writing this book of the fact that, you know, I'm white and middle class, and the fact that I am admitting that I feel like a bad mother in a public arena, like there's a certain element of privilege that comes with that, right? Because if I were a woman of color, or, you know, if I came from a more marginalized background, then that could have, you know, some more serious consequences. So it was something that very much informed pretty much every single element of the research in writing this book, I would say.
Yeah, I was really struck by the women you talked to for this chapter. One of them really like expressed that it just isn't something that she thinks about as a Black mother. It just doesn't play into her self-conception, like worrying about whether she's a bad mom. And you wrote that Black mothers have to worry about their kids' survival.
Yeah.
And I think that really like put such a sharp point on it for me, that Like, it is such a luxury to chase these ever-evolving standards because you know that those baselines, like, that everything is lined up for those baseline needs to be met, that your kids will be allowed to live and have the benefit of the doubt and be given opportunities to thrive. And you can kind of sit around being like, oh, but his classmates all baked something for the bake sale. And because I didn't, like, maybe I'm a bad mom and I should just, like, go to therapy about it some more, you know? Like, that's a bit of a luxury.
Yeah, that was the one, when she said that, that was the one point where I was like, maybe I shouldn't be writing this book. You know? I never really thought that until she said that. I was like, yeah, I just feel pretty stupid writing this book. But I mean, I think it's all kind of rolled into one, you know, mm-hmm. like without sort of going down the road of like intersectionality and, you know, how everybody's struggles are kind of compressed into one. I mean, I think that it's kind of, you know, we're all sort of in the same battle here in a lot of ways.
As you said earlier, like a lot of these constructions come from some sort of imperative in the culture. And you write about also like during slavery, the way that Black motherhood was constructed as fundamentally separate from white motherhood in order to justify the use of like Black labor to help raise white children and to remove Black mothers from their children. And I thought that was really, really striking as well.
And how it's being perpetrated today with CPS.
Right.
Like quite literally.
Right. There's like a straight line from that to what we see today.
Yeah. But the way that you say like that they're all bound together is completely true. And it made me think more about like the different ways that we see the same kind of dilemmas of motherhood and the demands of motherhood reflected in different four different identities and in different settings. Like the sort of like, I don't know if I can have it all, like existential crisis of the educated professional, predominantly white woman, is like really not so different in terms of where it comes from, like
exactly,
the underlying structural causes than the single working class mom who has to leave her kid at home alone to go to work. They're both just like, how do I balance these two responsibilities? And it's impossible because they demand completely contradictory things from me. But instead of like making cute movies about Sarah Jessica Parker about it and then being like, it's okay. Hey, you got it, mama. For women without those privileges, they could be jailed or lose their kids.
Yeah. I mean, the infrastructural causes are essentially the same, right? It's the type of things that people take for granted in most industrialized countries. You know, it's the lack of paid leave. It's the lack of on-site childcare at various workplaces. You know, things that mothers in, you know, Sweden and Denmark, they just completely take for granted. I mean, that's basically the root cause of both of those dilemmas, right? The only difference is, as you pointed out, Sarah Jessica Parker makes movies about the former, whereas, you know, low-income women of color is penalized, you know.
Right. The consequences are different, even
dire,
if kind of the underlying, like, causes are quite similar.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So as I was reading those chapters, I was like, wow, this is what it means to say, like, if you really center the needs of the most vulnerable women, that's how we get better outcomes for all of us. When you look at what these mothers are dealing with, you're like, wow, we really do need universal paid maternal leave. We really do need universal childcare access, because with those structural supports, these women's lives could be so completely different. And instead, they're being punished for not having access to those supports. But we would all benefit. Like, every mom would benefit.
Of course. And I think, I mean, I don't consider myself a politics writer or like somebody who's super focused on policy. So I didn't want to, you know, harp on that really in the book, because it's not really like a political treatise. It's a bunch of essays about like MILFs and Peg Bundy. Like, I'm just like a little internet like gremlin, basically. Like,
no, same.
I have opinions that, like, I'm a progressive, like, I have opinions about those things, but I'm not smart enough to be, like, on my soapbox being, like, here's why we should be like the Nordic countries, although I guess I did just kind of say that on your
podcast. I think we can be on that podcast even if we're dumb.
But I guess the point that I was sort of trying to make with the book is that these tropes about being a bad mother exist as a distraction from the fact that these social safety nets don't exist. It's a distraction from the feeling like we are inadequate and like we can never live up to these ideals, distract us from the fact that we don't have any support, and they make us too exhausted to complain about it. Because, like, if we really thought about it for a second, I feel like we'd be rioting in the streets, you know?
Yeah.
But we're not going to do that if we just feel like we're trying to live up to an impossible standard all the time.
Yeah. Like, instead of this woman was clearly failed by the system, she could have done a good job, like this good mom, but she right. didn't. She's a bad mom. She's,
exactly.
She's a failure. Yeah.
Exactly.
And I then feel like that's also just like an extension of the story of like being a woman, right? It's like the same kind of thing with beauty standards.
Yeah. I mean, I think this book very much, or at least I hope that people who don't have kids get something out of this book for that reason. Like, I don't think it's about being a mother. And I was very like concerned or like conscious of the fact when we were marketing it that it wasn't marketed specifically as like a book for moms. Like, I think it's about sort of the state of womanhood in general. I don't really care if men read it. I actually would prefer if men don't read it.
It's none of their business.
It's not for them.
Yeah, it's not for them. I mean, they can buy it for their wives.
They should. Funny. They should buy it. They buy two copies, men. Why not?
Yeah, buy a couple copies.
You don't have to read it. You just have to buy it.
Give them to women in your life. You don't have to explain yourself. She'll love it.
Well, maybe you can explain yourself a little bit.
like, here, honey.
Yeah. No, yeah. This is not. When I had my baby shower, my sister-in-law got me like a little pocket edition of a vintage, like, or it was my bridal shower, sorry, of this little old manners book called Don'ts for Wives.
I love that.
I know. I was like, thank you. I'm going to do all of these things.
Yeah.
And she was like, you should.
Yeah. So you're the target audience. That's exactly what
exactly.
I wanted. Yeah. I wanted people to buy this like for baby showers or for Mother's Day. And like,
yes,
my husband was
I
like, nobody's going to do that. And I was like, I would do that.
Some of us would do that.
Trolls would do that, you know. But
there are more
women
trolls
who are
out there
too
than
online,
you could ever
like
conceive
us.
Of.
Yeah, women who are too online, exactly.
But speaking of men for a second, and something that you do discuss throughout the book is our double standard for fatherhood versus motherhood. It's like, yeah, we do not seem to have an overarching idea of like the bad father that like haunts men throughout their lives in the same way that we have like the bad mom. Like, why is that? Like, what is behind these strongly divergent conceptions of these parental roles?
I mean, it just doesn't exist. Like, Claire, I'm sure you can speak to this. Like,
yes.
It just doesn't, there's no standards for fatherhood whatsoever. Right? Like,
yeah.
If you see a father like on the playground holding a diaper bag, everybody's like, "Oh my god, what a dilf." You know, like what an active and engaged parent. There are like entire Instagram accounts called DILFs at Disneyland. Have you guys seen these?
No.
No, but I've seen things in that ilk. I actually like when I think about becoming a mother and I think about what a boon it would be for my husband to be walking around Brooklyn like with a stroller.
It should do
I actually
mad.
Get enraged.
Yeah,
I actually
yeah,
get
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Like I just thinking about it makes me like so fucking mad.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. You should. Yeah. I love that. I love that you get mad about that.
No, it was a very like it was a very interesting thing to observe how like when I was pregnant, I got a lot of comments on how radiant I was. And then once I gave birth, that ended. I like never heard a compliment about my looks ever again. But I heard a lot about how my husband was turning into a delf.
Really?
And I was like, I mean, we're both not eating because we're so busy. We're both haggard. I don't know why. He looks like he's thriving to you. And I don't. There's just like a glow.
Because the standards are just so fucking low. They're just on the floor. And that hasn't changed even remotely. Motherhood is considered like an identity on the internet and fatherhood just isn't. Like, you barely see any content that's targeted at fathers. And if it is, it's if you see like on your reels, like if you scroll, my husband's algorithm is all like, dad's being fun. And dad's like pulling pranks on their kids. And like dad's, you know, lip syncing to like wrestling audios, and all of the mom content that I get on my algorithm is like stressed out moms like edit horror montages while they're stuck in a snow day with their toddlers, or like it just focuses on stress and anxiety and how horrible it is to be a parent. And like that's very telling, you know?
Yeah.
Motherhood is an identity is wrapped up in stress. Fatherhood is an identity is wrapped up in fun. Like, why?
Yeah. I've noticed that my husband also gets a lot of like yeah, comedy from the dads about like how toddlers are just like so hilarious. And also their wife is so hilarious with all her like mom anxieties. And I get a lot of stuff that's like, I didn't sleep train. And here I am in my beautiful nap dress with my like perfect child who adores me because I'm just like so calm and angelic. And then the comments are full of people being like, if you sleep trained, you're a monster. And I'm like, wait, every day I go online and my algorithm tries to make me feel like the worst piece of shit on earth. And my husband is sending me every like little reel he sees. And they're all like hilarious dads having a great time.
Yeah. Every day we sign on to like do the podcast and Claire is like, here's the weird evangelical Christian propaganda that's been funneled my way about motherhood.
Why is your algorithm like that?
Because clearly I'm deep down I'm trad. And it's like trying to bring that out in me.
No, I think the problem is you like sweaters from slightly crunchy brands occasionally, and that like just changed your whole
outfit. That definitely that's a big problem. And I think also like when you're a new anxious mom, which my first son did not sleep, it was a nightmare. He would wake up at 3 a.m and be like, it's time to get up, and we didn't know what to do. And so when I saw content about something like how to deal with sleep problems, I would look at it and I would read all the comments, go into a spiral, and then the algorithm would be like, ah, she wants more of this. And it would keep sending me more.
And there's also probably an assumption that because you're like a young-ish mother, that you skew conservative, which is also like, I mean, an insidious thing, kind of like a very insidious assumption that I have noticed occasionally on my Instagram feed.
Yeah, 100%. I think it is definitely, it's been talked about this way. It is kind of the female equivalent of like that red pill like algorithm that like picks you up being interested in kind of more mainstream interests for young men, and then suddenly you're watching like Nazi propaganda on YouTube. Like, I do think that as a mom in your 30s, you end up on a similar kind of like riptide on social media.
Especially now that influencers are becoming more canny about capitalizing on, right-wing influencers in particular, are becoming more canny about capitalizing on motherhood, millennial motherhood as an identity. Like, when I first started getting Candace Owens reels about Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni, I was oh, this is bad. This is really, really bad.
Yeah. No, it's dark. Like, for years, your algorithm is kind of, like, giving you stuff that it knows you'll like. And you're like, yeah, this is what the world is like. And then it senses that you're a mom. And you're like, oh, my God, there's so much, like, horrific shit out there that is suddenly being served to me.
Yeah, like trafficking, conspiracy theories, and, yeah, all this shit.
For a while, I was getting lots of reels from, like, young Catholic moms who are, like, getting dressed in a long floral dress every day makes me a better mom.
He used to send
literally like literally it makes me a better mom. And I was like, wait, I did not know that I had somehow signaled that this is who I am now, but they've decided I'm ready to be radicalized.
Is it working?
Yeah. No, I vote Republican now. That was very effective.
Yeah, she's MAHA, MAGA, all of it.
I'm like, finally, somewhere where I'm valued. Yeah, it's I wonder if that we are going to see this start to shift at all as millennial men are being a little bit more involved in parenting. Like, was there, I feel like the existence of mommy blogging and mommy influencers preceded what does exist now of like dad content on social media. Like, do you think that there is a future where we start applying any of these expectations to dads?
No, not remotely.
Never.
No.
Yeah.
Not as long as the other expectations are in place. No.
Mm-hmm.
I saw some study somewhere that dads are doing like marginally more labor in the household, which is great, you know, but it's still marginal. It's still not equal. It's still not like the distribution is anywhere near what it should be on average.
Well, you know that if there were ever a hint that any man anywhere is doing more at home than his wife, that would be perceived as like a great injustice, and feminism has gone too far. So like the right split is always going to be the mom doing more. And then...
Yeah,
that people are comfortable with that.
And I feel like with how far right the culture is right now, we don't even hear these conversations anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not even something that people are really talking about.
Yeah, we're almost like fighting for our lives right
exactly.
now, like literally.
Exactly. You know, our cities are under attack. Let's try to live. Yeah.
I mean, you do write about trad wives and momfluencers, specifically with trad wives. Like, you do a very good job of really trying to cultivate, be critical, but also cultivate like empathy for people like Hannah Nealeman. And I think that's something that like I sometimes have a hard time with, because I just look at a lot of these accounts and I'm like, you are simply a funnel for extremely noxious political agendas. So I wonder how you think about that, like balancing that like individual empathy for these individual moms and also coming out with like a very strong criticism of the way that this content is being used to funnel women into these like really, really terrifying, really harmful right-wing spaces.
Well, I've done a lot of reporting on Mormon momfluencers in the past, so I think that empathy was kind of, or just that understanding, I guess, was just kind of there. Because I've spoken to a lot of these women, and I think it's really interesting how they're largely very educated because the church puts a lot of emphasis on like education, and they're largely very literate because the church puts a lot of emphasis on diligent record keeping and writing and like being a good writer. But the church also puts a lot of emphasis on getting married young and having babies young and dropping out of the workforce and being a good housewife. So these are like very ambitious, very educated women who are then told to just drop all of that education and ambition the second they turn 22 and get married and have children. And so they're obviously like very frustrated, and they figure out how to channel this frustration through influencing, which I think is pretty smart. You know, like I think that's a pretty intelligent, objectively intelligent and savvy way to sort of monetize these pretty dire or dismal circumstances. You know, not that Ballerina Farm, who is very rich and very beautiful, is living in dire circumstances. But, you know, it's not a great situation for these women, and they figure out how to make the best of it. So I think that's a really interesting context or lens through which to look at this. That said, I hate their content. I find their content vile. I think that it absolutely is a radicalization channel. I think that this little shell game that they play, where they deny that they're political or they deny that they're trying to influence other women, is, I mean, look, I can't look inside people's hearts. Like, I don't know what Hannah Nealeman's motivations are, but I don't believe that. I think it's disingenuous. I've spoken to enough of these women to know that they are very aware that their audiences are largely women like us. You know, mm-hmm. like a lot of their followers are coastal, millennial, working, single women who are considering having children or who look up to this lifestyle. And they had spoken to me about how, well, maybe if they look at my content, that this is something that they're going to want to do. And the church encourages us to proselytize this lifestyle. You know, like they're very aware of this. So that's scary. But frankly, I think it's scarier that there is such a big audience for it. I think it's scarier that there's such an appetite right now for it. And I think it's scarier that there seems to be such an overcorrection on behalf of millennial and Gen Z women to the girl boss, gaslight, gatekeep, girl boss, have it all millennial feminism culture that we were talking about earlier, that we were brought up with, that the pendulum has seemingly swung so far right that there seems to be genuine interest in this. That's terrifying to me.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And like, I was joking a little bit before, but like, I do think that I personally am kind of like very vulnerable to this kind of propaganda, because I loved Little Women growing up, right? I was like, I'm going to put on a bonnet in my house and pretend that I like live in the 1850s type of kid. My mom died when I was young, so I think that I also kind of romanticized the work of motherhood. Thank you. And like, I had a great mom. I loved her. She had a career, but it was the more flexible one so that she could do the bulk of the childcare and like was there for us after school and all those things. And so I do think that like when I hit that point in my adulthood and I was ready to have kids, I had a somewhat romanticized vision of that. And I wanted to believe that it could be like that. And then you see this propaganda and you're like, see, that mom is still happy. She still has a beautiful life. It's not all spit up on her old gray t-shirt and like messy hair. And like, I could still feel beautiful and peaceful and be a mom at the same time. I don't have to give that up. And that is like so insidious because obviously once you have kids, life is a lot more complicated than that. And you can become very vulnerable in lots of ways that are not shown in that kind of propaganda, especially if you pursue that kind of parenthood where you often become financially dependent on your partner. It's very alarming when I realize how seduced I am by that kind of thing. And it takes more active effort than I would like to remember how fake it is.
It is
because
very
you
alarming.
Want that yeah. on some level.
Yeah, it requires a lot of discernment and a lot of critical thinking, which I think is something that I'm very concerned about our kids growing up with social media and the onslaught of social media, because that's not something that I see them being taught. Mm-hmm. Is how to discern between like reality and fantasy and influencer mm-hmm. culture. And it's hard enough for us, you know, like
right.
how vulnerable like you are to this type of messaging. And I see the appeal of it too. You know, like I feel like I am so, I feel like I had sort of like an academic, too academic an understanding of that type of content at this point, just because I've written a lot about it, that I can really see the appeal of it. Like on an emotional level, like when I see Hannah Nealman, I just see like a hot lady like traipsing in hen shit, you know, like
accurate.
I don't, and I'm not like, I want this. I'm just like, oh, I'd like to be as hot as she is. Like, I'd like to have her money, but I don't want to have like 12 kids or however many kids she has.
Well, just marry the scion to the JetBlue fortune and you yeah. too could have.
And
what
you'll
she
still
had.
Have to work so hard that sometimes you need to lie down for an entire week
yeah, and exactly. lie about having the epidural or whatever. But I get it. I mean, I see the appeal. It makes me nervous that future generations won't have those tools of discernment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm like, what responsibility do I have to literally sit my children down and show them right-wing propaganda and explain to them myself, since I know they're not going to like be learning this kind of media literacy in middle school or something. Like that's the kind of parenting concern that we have to contend with now. I often in my head kind of combine momfluencers and mommy bloggers and the Huns that you also write about, MLM moms, because so much about where they come from to me is just that structural factor that you talk about where you're stepping away from the workforce so that you can be the primary caregiver, but you still maybe need to make money or you want to feel like you have an interest or a goal outside of wiping butts. You have to find something that fits into your life. And as like a content creator, oh God, like for me, I was like, I guess I have to write about my kids because that's what I spend a lot of my time learning about now. How do I put that to use? You know, how do I turn that into my work? But then also the idea of using your social networks that you're maintaining as a stay-at-home mom to sell makeup or leggings also makes a lot of sense to me. Like, what should we all be taking away from these like mom types about like the position that women are put in once they become moms? Like, what should we be, instead of being like, these women are so annoying, like, what's the bigger picture here?
Yeah, I think you summed it up very well. This is the currency they have. You know, these are the circumstances that these women are dealing with a lot of the time. And also there are economic circumstances at play, certainly. You know, maybe they can't afford childcare, so they have to drop out of the workforce. But, and also it's, I think what was really interesting when I was researching that chapter that I didn't know before is that I had assumed all these women were white. Mm-hmm. And upper middle class. And that's not
the MLM.
Yes.
Moms.
And that's not the case. That's not the case at all. Actually, a lot of like there's a very sizable percentage of women who join MLMs who are working class and Latino. And the MLMs are really, you know, working overtime trying to target those communities, which is disgusting and predatory in itself. But it's just a much more complex picture than I think documentaries like Lula Rich and a lot of podcasts sort of like exposing MLMs presents. And I think that we need to consider our knee-jerk contempt of mm-hmm. these women and kind of like examine that they have a lot of very complex reasons for joining. It's kind of the same, like I think I write a sentence in the anti-vax moms chapters where I'm like, Do I think these women are predators? Yes. Do I think they're victims? Also yes.
Yeah.
I think it's the same thing. I think it's a similar dynamic.
Yeah. I sometimes think of moms as like the middle managers of life. Like, I think that also puts them in that middle level in an MLM where it's like, because you're working caring for little vulnerable people, you have this power and you can hurt people. But also there are so many other people above you kind of bearing down on you and trying to shape your behavior. And so you're also a victim. And you return to that a couple times, that idea that they're victims and also predators. That is a dynamic I think that moms get kind of sandwiched into a lot. And it makes me depressed.
Yeah, I mean, the Maha chapter was really striking to me because you make that argument of both, again, predator and victim very well. You talk about the fact that a lot of these women come to these set of quite noxious beliefs almost well-earned, right? Like, they have been victimized by the healthcare system. They have been gaslit by medical professionals. They have been, like, dismissed. The needs of their children have been dismissed. And the space that ends up offering them, like, a home then uses their voices to push policies that ultimately make their children and all children and the whole country significantly less safe and less healthy.
One of the things that I find so terrifying and evil about RFK Jr. that I think hasn't been talked about enough in the media is how much, for years, years and years, like, he's been doing this for 20 years almost, is how good he is at preying on the very, very real fears of mothers with very, very sick children. It is disgusting. It is, and I say this as the mother of a sick child. I haven't spoken about this in doing these interviews, but shortly after I finished editing the book, my kid was diagnosed with something called PANDAS, which is like a neuropsychiatric, like, immune disorder. And it's been just something that we've been dealing with for the past few months, and it's been a nightmare.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. It's been fucking awful. But it's kind of crazy that I wrote this chapter before that happened, because this is exactly the experience that we've been having. Like, just trying to find answers over and over and over again. And it's not like a super common illness, and it's not like highly understood by like everybody in the medical field, or certainly not by like lay people. So just having to explain it over and over again, and having to navigate the system, and having people not understand or say that we're like making this up or say that we're crazy. And I completely fucking understand where these women are coming from.
Right.
You know, I completely, and I understood it before, you know, I understood when I was writing it. Like, I completely understand how you can feel like the system failed you, and you can turn to these voices that are saying, you are not alone. We hear you. We understand you. And here, we have answers, and we think that your voice is important, and that you would feel like that would be so powerful. And I actually think that that is the narrative, that is the story that I wish was told more often in the media, and that I'm surprised hasn't been told. Because I guess it's sexier to talk about like the Maha momfluencers and people like House and Habit. But really, I mean, this is a guy who has built a career preying on the mothers of very sick children. Charlotte and shit.
Yeah. Also, like, I'm just even like extra struck just as you're laying this out by the fact that the story that's been told is about these like moms and the crazy shit they are pushing. And at the top of this power structure is, of course, an old white man, right? Like, it's like a tale as old as fucking time. Like, who's the greatest beneficiary of this entire narrative?
And they think he's a god. I have a theory, and again, I am not a politics writer, so this is completely unsupported, but I have a theory that if he had not endorsed Trump, Trump would not have won. Because I follow all of these Maha, like, you know, these wellness influencers and all of these people who were not particularly political, who had millions and millions of followers, and all of these momfluencers, and they all just, like, the second that that happened, they were all for Trump.
No, it's hard to say, you know, obviously, like, even if you were a politics writer, it's always, like, so hard to point to one thing. There's no way to prove something like that. But, like, these are the watershed moments that, you know, there might be 2 or 5 or 10 of them, but it shifted things in that direction. And it's, in a way, though, it's like, it makes sense because RFK Jr. and I think Trump have a similar appeal for a lot of women in that segment of the electorate, which is like we're used to being sort of talked down to and abused and treated badly by men. And so it doesn't, we're not in a place to be pearl clutching over how disgusting and rude this particular asshole is. But he's an alternative, and he is representing an opportunity to be listened to in a different way than the other dudes who have been not solving our problems in the establishment for a long time. Like, they represent such similar things, I think, for like you would think, like, why would you listen to this like piece of shit dude? But they aren't. Like, at that point, it's like, what's the difference?
Well, what's interesting to me is a lot of the moms that I spoke to for that chapter, and also just over the past 2 years in reporting, hate Trump. Really held their nose in voting for Trump, like found him repulsive. They voted for him because Bobby said so.
That's fascinating.
That, you know, because they trust Bobby with their lives, and because Bobby helped their kids, and, you know, so I do think that they're, I don't know if I would go so far as to say, like, the women who voted for Trump are bad people, and the women who voted, you know, the women who voted for him because of, you know, RFK are good people. Like, it's not that black and white, obviously, but, like, I don't know. I think it's really telling.
Yeah, there's a very powerful pull to feeling seen after feeling ignored. And I do think that's actually a theme that comes up throughout your book a lot, is this like feeling of not being listened to, this feeling of being invisible that a lot of women are familiar with, whether or not they have kids. But maybe the stakes feel even higher.
Absolutely.
When you are also dealing with the needs of your children. And it does feel like that. If we don't want to lose all of these women to propaganda, there has to be space made in our circle, right? On the left. And like, I guess the question is like, how do we do that? Maybe that's a bigger question for all of us to noodle on. But I think it's something that Claire and I think about a lot.
Yeah. A couple people have asked me that in these interviews, and I'm always just like, I don't know, man. Like,
yeah. No, I don't think anyone here is going to like have the fucking magic bean to like solve it. But like,
I mean, I like everybody else, I am very inspired by what's been going on in Minneapolis and seeing how powerful of a force empathy is and community and solidarity. And also how many women, how many mothers in particular, and have come out to just say this is horrifying. And a lot of women who, like, you wouldn't expect to. A lot of women who maybe, you know, voted for Trump in 2024, to the point that, like, it's scaring the GOP enough for them to call these women wine moms or to, you know, smear them, like, in keeping with the theme of the book. Renee Good was smeared as a bad mother who should have been at home with her kids instead of, you know, out protesting.
Right.
Like, the power of these mothers is scary to these men. The anger of these mothers is scary to these men. And Claire, you were talking before about, like, you know, anger and, you know, the force of anger and how you fear your anger. Mm. And I feel I'm a very angry person too, obviously. I mean, I feel the same way. But I think anger is the most interesting emotion that there is, and also the most powerful and the one that is going to change the world.
Yeah.
And what I would really like to see, like, it is community and it is empathy and it is love that is bringing people out into Minneapolis, but it's also fucking anger. People are fucking angry as shit, and they should be. And that's really what I want to see. You know?
Yeah.
I want to see women get angry. There's so much to get angry about.
Yeah. No, my therapist once asked me what role anger served for me, and I was like, what do you mean?
Like all the roles,
it gets shit done. Yeah.
I mean
I don't know how to explain that. When I'm angry, things happen, and when I'm not angry, they don't. And there's a fear that, you know, obviously that can be weaponized against the people who are closest and most vulnerable to you, but it can also be very effective in other arenas where it's really necessary. And this was a big conversation after the 2016 election. There were like multiple books specifically just about the rise of female rage and the political power of that. And right on time, Trump's back in office and everyone's thinking about angry women again for some reason. But it's true, like with Renee Good, like we were really seeing play out, that battle over what it means to be a good mom, and the conservatives saying a good mom is this sort of white angelic figure who is worthy of our, like, she might be like sexually assaulted by an undocumented immigrant, and while she's just at home defenseless with her children, and all of those other white moms who are out there angry at us, they're not, you don't have to listen to them. They can be disposed of because they're bad moms. And like the power of those labels in this moment is like, it can be terrifying, but also like we should be engaged in that conversation because it is very powerful.
Yeah, it proves that like we can use it in our favor. Like if the right can weaponize motherhood against women or against communities that are non-white, like we can also use, like, turn their own logic on its head. And, like, we are seeing that in Minneapolis.
And conservatives are happy to have an angry white mom if it's a mama bear in the Sarah Palin mold, right?
Yeah, it was really interesting to see this happen over the past few weeks. You know, all the wine mom discourse. First of all, cynically, I was like, oh, I should do a wine mom event and like reclaim it and to promote the book. But
you should, honestly.
Yeah, I need some advice on like how to do it. But it was also interesting, like in the context of the Maha Mom chapter, like because I had thought so much about how the right had sort of like venerated the anger of women when channeled through that context, and now they were seeing it in a left-wing context, and it just terrified them. So it was very interesting to see that opposition, and thrilling, I would say.
Yeah. No, it was inspiring. It was very inspiring. And yeah, like the idea is always that they have to convince women, white women especially,
go home,
stay home. We need you to go home, but also like to be warriors on their behalf when the time is right, like when they need women's anger, when it's in service of oppressing the people they need to oppress, it's very valuable to them. And then they'll talk about the mama bear and like, what's the difference between, you know, what kind of animal was it that she talked about? Was it a bear? Sorry, I'm butchering this. What's the difference between like a bear or something and a hockey mom lipstick?
It was a bear.
Was it a bear? I don't know. The point is, like, it's very, like, valorized to be that kind of, like, angry white mom when it's in service, when they're, like, the minions of the white patriarchy.
It was a grizzly bear.
A grizzly bear, yes. I knew I was missing something. Yeah. Well, I really appreciated that at the end of the book, you were kind of, you know, summing it all up with this message of, like, let's just let go of all of this. And as you've said before, like, let's not worry so much about being a bad mom. But do you think that it's, like, realistic for us to really deconstruct those? Or is the best we can hope for as a society to kind of, as Emma was saying, like, turn them on their head, put them to work for us? Like, is that something that we can do? Those, they're so deeply entrenched. So like, where do we go from here?
Yeah, there was a moment culturally that I sort of talk about this in the intro, and I kind of wish that I had written about it more because it's interesting to me and I haven't really seen it dissected. There was a moment culturally about 10, 15 years ago where the idea of being a bad mom was really being reclaimed. Mm-hmm. You know, there was that movie Bad Moms with Mila Kunis, and there was all this like cutesy wine mom merch, like it's drink a clock, don't talk to me until I've had my coffee and my wine. And we make fun of it now because it was cringe, but it was also like important. You know, there was like a real cringe but important conversation happening about, you know, the difficulties of motherhood, and moms were trying to break free of that. And then it kind of just stopped. And I'm not really sure why that is. I think maybe because we sort of realized that there were limitations to that conversation, that it was very white, that it was very upper middle class, that it was very millennial, you know, a certain brand of like millennial cringe feminist. But I don't think that was a good enough reason to stop that conversation. You know, I think that was a reason to take that conversation and maybe make it more sophisticated or make it more clever or evolve it in a different direction, which is kind of what I was hoping to do with this book. But I don't think that was a reason for that conversation to stop. And now what we're sort of seeing is that conversation go entirely in the different direction.
Yeah.
You're seeing snark subreddits where women are calling the police on moms with like 500 followers because their rooms aren't clean in a video, or they serve their kids powdered donuts for breakfast. or you're seeing, you know, stuff like Renee Good being smeared as an alcoholic or a bad mother because she was killed in broad daylight because she had the audacity to go out and protest her neighbors being kidnapped in the streets. Like, we're just seeing it swing so far in the other direction, the policing of motherhood, and being overtly told by people like J.D. Vance and Elon Musk, go home, stay home, have more children, get out of the workforce, this is what we want you to do, that it doesn't really feel like there's much hope for us to have that conversation again. I don't know. I mean, do you guys think that there is that, like, something like the bad mom or the one mom can, like, be reclaimed, that there can be, like, an extension of this discourse that isn't cringe?
I feel like there is some different iteration of it that I'm seeing more and more, which is, like, I'm a type B mom or a type C mom, which is, like, a little bit, like, self-deprecating. I don't have a perfect system for running my house. Like, I have one closet where everything's a mess, or, like, you know what I mean? Like, that's the extent to which I see it now, I would say. And it's so different from what you're describing. And I remember that moment as well. But what I feel like I often, it seems to me, has happened is that, like, there was this sense that, like, that conversation was too white-centric and too, like, privileged. And I don't think this was the intent of making that conversation more nuanced, but I think that this was sort of twisted by conservative people with an agenda. And now what I see a lot more is, like, you can just not have a kid. So if you did have one and you have all this privilege, what right do you have not to, like, pour literally everything into being the best mom possible? Mm. You know, you could have just, like, not had kids. And so you have no right to be a bad mom.
You see that from the left?
I feel like I see it just, like, out there. Like, I don't think that that was driven by the left, but I feel like it was kind of this sense that it was sort of tone deaf and privileged to say, like, oh, I'm a bad mom, was kind of latched onto in a certain way.
We're also very good at shooting ourselves in the foot on the left. I mean, let's not underestimate the degree to which we...
No, that's true. Well, and I haven't researched, so you keep being like, I'm not a politics writer, so I don't know. All of my takes are even far more underbaked and under-researched than that. I was just like, how do I reverse engineer this thing that I see everywhere now, which is, like, having kids is sort of like a luxury hobby that you've chosen as, like, this privileged, you know, woman in this society. So you just have to be really good at it, or else, like, you're throwing that away, or, like, you're being irresponsible with all of that privilege and choice that you are given. And maybe that's just my algorithm. I feel like I see this attitude a lot.
Yeah, I haven't really seen that. I will say that I think the left has really bad takes about motherhood as well. Mm. Like, really bad. But again, like, I think that might be a byproduct of me being, like, super online, you know, or,
yeah,
like, more online than the average person. Like, I don't know how prevalent the discourse of, like, crotch goblins, or, like, have you guys heard that phrase? Or
Yeah.
Or, like, the Our Child Free subreddit, or, you know, I don't know how, like, prevalent that discourse is for, like, non-online people. But, I mean, I do think that, like, there is sort of this perception on the left that anybody who has children is sort of inflicting them upon society, or inflicting them upon their own sense of, like, self and security. And that also strikes me as insane. But again, like, I think that's kind of a marginal point of view.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily, as you said, I'm way too online and I see the crotch goblin thing a lot. So obviously I'm, like, very sensitive as a mom. But I think that just, I wonder if the fact that, like, that kind of bad mom stuff was also kind of just, like, what was floating around in the ether. And if what we've replaced it with is, like, this mix of, like, conservatives being like, go live in a pasture and have babies, and a lot of people on the other side of the aisle kind of being like, well, if you must have children, then, like, obviously you have to do it in the best way possible, if that is, like, a kind of mix that is unfriendly to that idea of reclaiming bad mom as an identity. Like, I don't think that either of those attitudes that I see more commonly now is very friendly to reclaiming the bad mom label.
Yeah, it does seem kind of hopeless.
But everything is always in motion, okay? Like, who knows where we'll be in 2 years?
Yeah.
I guess where I feel hope just is in what we were talking about earlier. Like, the way that we are seeing these networks of women, of moms, organizing and, like, especially white women, white moms, utilizing that privilege in service of other people in their communities, like in Minneapolis. I wonder if the project of, like, reclaiming some of these things is, like, on pause because everything feels so fucking dire right now. And, like, for now, the best that we can hope for is just to release ourselves of a little bit of that, like, pressure and try to, like, do the work of releasing the people around us from those judgments as much as we can.
But also, like, maybe it will create a freedom, allow for a freedom from distraction. Like, maybe it's just an opportunity to pivot to, like, hey, white middle class moms, here's something better to worry about than whether you are, like, intensively helicopter parenting your child gently enough. You know, maybe you could be worrying about forming a mutual aid group in your neighborhood.
I mean, that is kind of what we're seeing.
Yeah.
That is kind of what we're seeing in these, you know, in I live in a very annoyingly woke hub of parenting in Brooklyn, and everybody's outraged, you know. Everybody's doing as much as they can. They're volunteering their time. They're, you know, donating money. They're, you know, 3D printing whistles if ICE comes along. I mean, there's really, like, a very strong sense of community here. You hear people talk about the same dumb shit at, like, parent meetings. But, you know, like, what you're going to bring to, like, the birthday party or whatever. But, like, you know, I think that mothers are really mobilized right now. And something that I also think that they're not buying into the wine mom shit. You know, I think that's really inspiring. Like, everybody was like, this is stupid, you know? Like, this
Yeah. I think I saw a lot of people, like, this is stupid. And also, like, okay, you want to label me that? Great. Throw that label on me. Like, that doesn't affect me. Whatever the right has done to kind of, like, turn their anger or their eye of, like, you are a bad mom onto these women who are organizing, it is not doing anything. It is not deterring that movement. And I think that that is a clear sign of, like, hope, that for a lot of women, there is, like, a good enough sense of self that it's, like, that new right that we see controlling the culture in this country only has so much power. Like, there is a limitation to it. And there is a way that we can resist.
Are you guys familiar with the anti-empathy movement?
Yeah.
No.
Unfortunately. Oh, my gosh. Emma, like, Ali Beth Stuckey is, like, a conservative Christian influencer. She wrote, like, a whole book
that's her that's thing.
Like,
okay.
Toxic empathy.
Oh, toxic empathy. Okay, yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay,
and
yes,
how the progressives weaponize toxic empathy. Yes. And her whole audience is, like, conservative millennial women. And after those images of that 5-year-old boy whose name escapes me at the bunny hat.
Liam Ramos.
Yeah. After those started circulating, she started tweeting about her book again and how the left is trying to manipulate you by capitalizing on your empathy. And don't let them pull on your heartstrings. Don't let them take advantage of your compassion. And the only thing I could really think was, they must be really scared right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They must be really scared right now to resort to that argument.
And I did read a handful of pieces that were like, even their audiences are not really falling for this bullshit. Like, there is a limitation to that propaganda.
There is.
Even within audiences that are, like, primed for it.
Because it's just so absurd, and it's such a shallow argument. And especially for mothers, you know, mothers of children like Liam Ramos, you know, who have little blue bunny hats and little, you know, blankies. Like, I'm going to cry, like, even thinking about it. Like, there's just to be told that your empathy is being manipulated. We see through that, you know.
That's, I mean, what else makes us human? Like, if we don't have that, like, what do we have? Whether or not we are parents, I don't know what we have in this world as human beings if we are devoid of empathy.
And I mean, it's a classic case of, like, projection on some level, because so much of the conservative movement is built on, like, weaponizing empathy to convince people that what they need to do is protect, like, white children and mothers who are being, like, preyed upon by sex traffickers or undocumented immigrants. But you can tell that it's a manipulation if you say, why did you arrest and detain and imprison this 5-year-old boy? And they say, oh, well, who feels bad about Lake and Riley? you know? And it's like, but that has nothing to do with this. You're trying to get me to feel bad about a objectively horrific thing that happened to someone by saying that it makes it okay for you to punish a small child who had nothing to do with that. But if I feel empathy for that small child, that's not manipulation. That's just the human recognition that that is a child who deserves care and protection and who has done nothing wrong.
They're also demanding that you have empathy for the white person and not the brown person. They're saying you have empathy for the wrong person.
Well, that's what it really is. That's what it really is. But they try to dress it up in other ways. But like, that's really what's at the heart of it. They're so confused that people are feeling empathy for brown people. And they're like, how can we convince them that it's okay not to feel empathy for specific people?
And I think mothers are seeing through that. And that's really inspiring to me. Like that mothers in particular, especially, again, like women who voted for Trump. They're fucking seeing through it. And that's really beautiful to me. Because empathy is not... I was actually just talking to an empathy researcher for a story I'm working on, not related to the book. But she was saying, you know, empathy is non-political. Like, I don't consider this area of research, you know, political or partisan at all. And it's non-political. It's not a political entity. It's just a human value that we all have. And especially the mothers. I mean, not especially mothers. We all have it. It doesn't matter who you are.
Yeah. Yeah, it just, it can, like, definitely put a very personal spin on it if you have, I mean, I have a 6-year-old, like, you know exactly what it would be like for that exact thing to happen to your child at that age, and it can feel very personal.
Yeah.
But of course anyone can react with horror to these scenes.
Yeah.
And you want to build a world where that can't happen to your child or to anyone's child.
They deserve a world that's better than this.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really, we're all very sad now, but I think that's a really good note to end on, because I do think ultimately, like, you end the book by kind of saying I'm letting go of worrying about being a bad mom. But what we're really seeing right now is this moment where we can't worry about that because we have to put our energies out into building a better society. And that's really what we should have been doing all along.
Yeah.
And that's kind of inspiring.
I think that's a really good takeaway. And it's a much better takeaway than I would have come up with. So thank you, Claire, for coming up with it.
I'm trying to be a positive thinker.
You can take that one to your next interview.
Yeah.
I will.
That one's that's for free. Yeah. But we truly loved reading the book so
much. Thank you
and
so
learned
much.
So much from it and laughed a lot.
Everyone should go pick up this book, One Bad Mother, in praise of psycho housewives, stage parents, momfluencers, and other women we love to hate. You can get it wherever you buy books, and it is out February 10th. So go order it. Go buy it from your local bookstore and have really great conversations with the people in your lives as a result, like we did. EJ, thank you so much for joining us. This has truly been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been so fun.
Yay.
Yay. And on that note, that's it for this episode of Rich Text.
Rich Text is hosted, produced, and edited by us, Claire Fallon and Emma Gray.
You can find the written version of Rich Text at clareandemma.substack.com.
You can find us on Instagram at clareandemmapod, and you can find our other podcast, Love to See It, wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as on TikTok at Love to See It Pod.
You can also find us individually on social media at Claire E. Fallon and at Emma Lady Rose.
We'll be back soon.